Buford Pusser was a wrestling man. Gave it up to come back home and work his land. Buford's size was out of sight. He just didn't like to fight, 'cause Buford was just a family man.
Well, I saw a tweet from you about an hour ago, which, first of all, never tweet while we're watching movies, tells me how much you're paying attention to them. And this one, I don't know how you weren't completely gripped by it. I scarcely looked away. You couldn't have pried me from it. But you you tweeted something about this guy, Centrist Madness, and how you thought he was doing a bit for years. I mean, I'm a connoisseur of all things centrist, but I actually don't know who this guy is. I take it he's not doing a bit.
I'm actually amazed you don't know Centrist Madness. Centrist Madness is this Twitter account who is a sort of belligerent centrist. He's always replying. I'm actually not sure if he is doing a bit or not. I mean, I think he might be doing a bit, but he's so committed to it. He knows all of the sort of online lefty people, where he's aware of them. He has an encyclopedic knowledge of them. He's always kind of owning them with like centrist logic in a way that, like, he's obviously much more fluent in that language than a Greg Proops is. But I don't know. I'm glad you raised this, because I'm actually hoping that some of our listeners who are familiar with him, he's quite visible on the platform X, formerly known as Twitter. I'm hoping there are listeners out there who will know a little bit more about what is Centrist Madness's deal. Where does he come from? Why is he the way he is? Is he just a bit? Is he drill?
Well, looks like he follows me, and also looks like I have him muted, so. Anyway, I'm always down to find out about new guys, so I don't know, maybe I'll unmute him and see where this takes me. Well, we also got to talk about this deleted scene from Forrest Gump. Was this your first time encountering this? Because it certainly was for me, and I kind of assumed it was doing a bit for a couple of minutes until I realized, well, no, this is Tom Hanks. It's clearly Forrest Gump. Looking forward to the extended, you know, director's cut that includes the extra 2.5 hours of scenes like this.
Oh man, it was so great. This was getting passed around. It must have been on the DVD. I don't know. We'll link to it. It is a deleted scene from Forrest Gump, sat on the bridge at the March on Selma, where the cops unleash Rottweilers on Martin Luther King and the demonstrators, and Forrest Gump comes in with a stick, like, here, boys, don't attack, go this way. And then he goes up to MLK and says, I'm sorry, Mr. King, they're just dogs, they don't know any better. This was cut from the movie. And I had the same experience as you. For the first like couple seconds, I thought, oh, this can't be. But no, it truly is. It really was Tom Hanks. And then I thought, well, if this was actually in the movie, would it have made sense in 1994? Is it just strange because Forrest Gump has been grandfathered into the culture where all of the scenes in it, like if you took that scene where young Forrest teaches Elvis how to dance, or older Forrest moons LBJ, or, you know, all the scenes in it, would that have a similar punch if you just presented them for the first time out of context today?
I don't know. I mean, doesn't he also like cause the Watergate scandal? Like he exposes the burglary.
I'm going to contradict myself. I think there is something about that deleted scene with MLK that is like, it was wisely cut because it is a bridge too far. I mean, you're taking one of the most sainted moments in American history, one of the greatest standing against injustice moments in, hell, world history, iconic, legendary. And you're also taking like a hate crime, you know, unleashing Rottweilers on civil rights protesters, and you're using it as like ammunition for Forrest Gump to do something wacky. But then I realize what movie came out in 1998, a little movie called Life is Beautiful, which was all about Roberto Benigni bringing joy and merriment to his little son at Auschwitz. And the whole plot of that movie was like, he has to shield his son from the true reality of what is happening, which, by the way, I understand that if you were in the camps, there was no shielding anybody from the reality of what was happening. The ugliness is pretty much on full display.
You know, well, I actually disagree with you there, and I'll tell you why. It's because I finally got around to seeing a little movie called The Zone of Interest. And Wouldn't you know it? Turns out it's really fucking good. Highly recommend it.
You know, we have come a long way that Zone of Interest was this year's Oscar Holocaust movie as opposed to Life is Beautiful. History is certainly not necessarily a linear march to progress, but that suggests progress.
Well, if people haven't seen it, I don't know, skip the next, you know, minute or two because I don't want to spoil it for you. It is very much worth going in as blind as you can be when it comes to a movie that's been talked about so much. But the film is just unbelievably restrained about what it's willing to show you. And because virtually the entire film takes place in this kind of like idyllic middle class residence that the Hesses have set up, literally up against the wall of the camp. Like what it succeeds in doing and what is so kind of special about it is that it makes these, you know, truly diabolical and evil people kind of like the audience surrogate characters. And so you experience the ambient horror of this kind of as they do. Or at least, you know, you hear and see the same things that they do. And I mean, I don't know, just some of the shots, particularly the ones from their back garden, you know, while, you know, Mrs. Hess is telling her friend about like the vegetables they're planting and stuff. The things that you can see in the distance, the things that you can hear. I mean, I understand why this movie won. I believe it won the Oscar for sound, right? Absolutely incredible. I have not seen Life is Beautiful, but I'm going to go out on a limb and say The Zone of Interest, probably a better fucking movie.
There is, I think, something to be learned about the progression from the median mainstream Holocaust movie going from Life is Beautiful and Schindler's List, which, by the way, much better film than Life is Beautiful. No disrespect to Schindler's List, but to The Zone of Interest. I'm sorry to keep saying end of history on this podcast. I promise I'll put a moratorium on the phrase at some point, but it's just so
goddamn. I've heard that before.
It's so useful. Life is Beautiful could only have been made in a moment where it's like, oh, well, we're all done with that. And, you know, the healing process has led us to this point where we can make the Holocaust can become grist for a fable, a sentimental, cloying vanity project for this comedian, you know? The Holocaust can be a backdrop for his shenanigans. Or in the case of Schindler's List, which has, I mean, again, I'm oversimplifying it. There are moments, of course, where Spielberg attempts to complicate the ending of the film. You know, the famous scene, why didn't I give up this ring? If I had given this ring, I could have saved more lives. You know, scenes like that. By the way, quite the clunkiest scene in the movie, but nevertheless, you can see what Spielberg was going for with it. You know, it ends on a note of catharsis. Spielberg, when he does movies about historical atrocities, does tend to be interested in, you know, the people who fought against them or, you know, brought the system back into order. And in the 90s, you know, the decade of Forrest Gump, that would have been a resonant message.
Incidentally, this is going back a bit in the conversation, but I feel like the moment I found out that Forrest Gump wasn't a Steven Spielberg movie, like that was for me what it must have been like for people to hear that the Challenger had blown up. You know, I just couldn't believe it.
Who wants this? Come on. Here we go. Get that. Sorry they interrupted your parade. They're just dogs. They don't know any better.
I want to raise one last piece of movie-related news. It's not news. It's a movie-related matter before we get into our episode.
A little bit more on the forthcoming series, The Penguin.
Folks, he's the clown prince of crime. No, wait, that's the Joker. Actually, on that, can I just say, I'm a little tired of these same four or five Batman villains coming up over and over again. I'm sorry. How many times can I see the Joker? How many times can I get excited about Catwoman? Batman, he's got a whole rogues gallery. He's got Egghead. He's got Clock King. He's got that one that Milton Berle played on TV. He's got King Tut. Like, come on. I'm tired of the same. Let's get the dark and gritty King Tut, for God's sake.
Well, fear not, because there's probably like, I don't know, a 70% chance that the next 5 years, they're going to spend like $300 million on a Poison Ivy movie. I don't know. It'll star like Anya Taylor-Joy or something. And then it'll be, you know, they'll film the entire thing and then it'll become one of those things that the studio writes off and never sees the light of day. That's the reality we live in. I wouldn't worry. worry about it.
But anyway, regarding movie-related matters, Rolling Stone published one of their listicles. You love these when Rolling Stone does a list. You know, this is a, this is a pinata, you know? Hanging really low, got a great big
unironically mallet. I do actually like Rolling Stone listicles of, you know, top albums, you know, in the same way that I like, you know, the Empire top 500 movies or whatever, because the whole premise of ranking things that way, unless the criteria are incredibly stringent, which of course they never are when it comes to these sort of lists, like the whole exercise is completely pointless. But then from the pointlessness, from the ferment of discussion that flows from the pointlessness, I don't know, sometimes you realize, you know, what you like better or what you hate.
Well, certainly the Rolling Stone top 500 albums list was useful to me, you know, as a young audiophile. But now Rolling Stone does a list every week, and they're just engagement farming. That's all they are. They take some poor schmuck and say, in this case, give me 50 terrible movies by great directors.
Man, sorry to interrupt you, but I saw this list and I know exactly what it is you're about to bring up.
Well, I'll take a bit of a circuitous route to get to it, because some of the names on here and some of the choices are pretty funny. Number 10, How the Grinch Stole Christmas by Ron Howard. I mean, definitely a bad movie. Ron Howard, though, great director. You know, I guess that's in the eye of the beholder. But listen, fans of this podcast will know that one of the greatest movies of the last 10 years was Clint Eastwood's The 1517 to Paris. Number 23 on this list, The 1517 to Paris.
I knew that's where this was going, and you and I are of one mind on this. I can kind of understand how some people watched that movie and they just, you know, didn't get it, or they thought it was, you know, it's kind of conservatively encoded in a way that they've trained themselves to be put off by. But, you know my thoughts on it. You introduced me to that movie. I think it's great.
This writer, whose name I will not even dignify with stating, writes, Eastwood decided to cast the real-life heroes in The 1517 to Paris. It was a huge mistake since they simply weren't professional actors. Their big moment of heroism, like Sully's, lasted just a few moments. That forced Eastwood to pad the story out in monumentally boring ways by showing their life before the incident and the aftermath of it. Almost none of it was compelling.
So sorry, they wanted an entire movie made out of an action scene. All the boring shit where you just get to go on vacation with them in Europe. Like, that's what makes the movie so great.
I think The 1517 to Paris is a very useful, can you think critically about art exercise? Are you able to look at a thing and take the next step? Are you able to look at a thing that doesn't work the way a thing is normally supposed to work and then say, why is it working this way? You know, the idea that it's like, yeah, he cast these three utterly uncharismatic non-actors and told their boring life. The idea that that was by accident somehow, this it actually feels like a kind of level one bit of abstract thinking to be able to then go, okay, but why did he do that? So a wag of the finger at the voice of the counterculture, Rolling Stone.
It's less interesting than the point you're bringing up, but I am curious what you think Clint Eastwood's worst film is. You know, has he ever made a film that you actually think is bad?
Well, I know that some people say The Rookie with Charlie Sheen is not very good. I haven't seen that. That was a blatantly commercial enterprise that he made when his career was sort of in the doldrums. But man, the one that I've seen that I really don't have much time for is Invictus, his Nelson Mandela movie, all about Mandela becoming president of South Africa, uniting the country behind the white football team as a sort of show of like solidarity and everybody holding hands and coming together, you know, the true centrist madness. I'm just kidding. I'm sure the real story is just fine. I'm sure Nelson Mandela had good strategic instincts there in real life. But oh my God, the movie is incredibly boring.
Well, speaking of movies that are incredibly boring, we've got one for this week's show. It is a sequel of sorts, or this episode, I should say, is a sequel to one we did, 6 or 7 weeks ago on the classic 70s cult right-wing action vigilante movie, Walking Tall. This is the 2004 movie of the same title, starring Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
War hero Chris Vaughn has returned home.
Ma! Chris is here!
Like, you get tired of being all that you could be?
No, I'm still all I can be.
Yeah, we'll see about that.
But the town he thought he knew...
This ain't exactly home anymore.
...has lost its innocence.
Welcome to my world.
It was crystal meth.
Where'd you get the drugs?
From the guys at the casino.
I'm not gonna let this stand.
I'm the sheriff here. I'll tell you what'll stand.
Now, one man won't back down.
We were not even planning to watch this, but I actually, in a Michael and Us first, called Will about 10 minutes in to a movie that I had already agreed to watch. And I said, buddy, I can't do it. Can we save this one for another time? And he obligingly agreed.
That's right. 500 episodes in, we've had our first use of the Michael and Us veto. I had stumped pretty hard for this documentary, which we may do at some point, but, you know, definitely one that's in my wheelhouse of, you know, disgusting, depraved, ugly, subterranean, you know, filth and degradation. And
a movie so ugly, by the way, that it's like very difficult to find, apparently. Like, I was only able to find it because Will sent it to me, because, you know, he's a sicko who has this kind of thing lying around and watches it for comfort food.
Those are my exact words. And I was making a powerful case to Luke about, no, don't you see, this is the counterpoint to that Philip Seymour Hoffman documentary we watched. This is the other side of the end of history. This is where a certain tendency of the counterculture ended up, and we're going to wallow in the muck here, and you're going to see like the ugly end result of something that was once vital in the late 60s but ended up in a very dark and ugly place. And we got 10 minutes in and Luke said, man, I don't know, not in the headspace for it. This documentary is physically hurting me right now.
I do just want to underscore this, you know, folks, I am in a sense a professional critic. A large part of my trade, both as a writer and as a podcaster, involves deliberately exposing myself to things that I find ugly and objectionable and then writing about it. And so, you know, we'll leave you guessing as to what this thing that Will, you know, subjected me to actually was, at least for the time being. But just to underscore this point, it was something that within 10 minutes I realized I am not in a headspace where I'm going to be able to, yeah, distance myself emotionally from this. Have any kind of reaction to this that is separate from just the visceral revulsion that I'm feeling looking at the screen. We did Walking Tall instead.
Yeah, that's funny. I kind of like the other movie, honestly, but I guess we'll hash that out another time. We decided to go for something easy and watchable.
Yeah, and, you know, Walking Tall 2004, a boring as hell movie, very paint by the numbers. I kind of had a good time watching it. I was very amused when I went to the IMDb page and found that there's an extensive trivia section for it. All kinds of movie facts stated here, which are very funny. We'll come to those in a moment. I also find it pretty amusing that after we did the first Walking Tall, which of course is based on the life of one Sheriff Buford Pusser, that my computer now automatically corrects Buford Pusser to Buford Oyster for no particular reason I can discern. So I have the phrase Buford Oyster written all over the document in front of me.
Episode title? I'd like, well, that. It's not even clever is the thing.
In any case, Walking Tall is sort of a rehashing of the Buford Pusser story from the original 1973 film, except not really, because as that film announces right at the beginning, its plot is quote-unquote suggested by certain events, which is a disclaimer I have never seen on any other movie. And in a similar spirit, this movie begins by announcing itself. What does it say, Will? It says like...
It says inspired by a true story. Which, to be clear, it is inspired by a movie that was based on certain events in the life of a true story. So we are quite far away from, and actually, a fun fact, early in this movie, there's a scene where somebody picks up The Rock, and they're talking about a sheriff who died recently and says, yeah, he drove off the road, hit a tree, he was a good man. And the real Buford heads will know that that's a reference to Buford Pusser. That's an Easter egg. So I like to think the movie is establishing itself with that scene for legal purposes as completely unrelated to the life of Buford Pusser.
Well, it's just really funny because the phrase based on a true story, you know, that's already code for like, okay, we optioned somebody's life and just treated it like IP and kind of riffed on it and didn't actually adapt the story. but inspired by a true story, which, as you've already said, actually means inspired by a true story suggested by certain events. I don't know, say what you want about this series. It is leading the way in innovative new ways to say that absolutely nothing you're about to see actually happened or is true.
So instead of Buford Pusser, this movie concerns Sergeant Chris Vaughn, a former member of the Special Forces. Like Joe Don Baker in the original film, he returns to his small town, no longer south of the Mason-Dixon line. This time it's in Kitsap County, Washington.
Although it's actually just Squamish, BC is where they filmed it.
I think you will agree that, among other things, it's lacking the certain southern fried texture that the 1973 original had.
Yeah, you know what it actually reminds me of at the beginning is like when The Rock walks into town and you can kind of see the mountains and the forests off in the distance. It's a lot like the beginning of Rambo, don't you think? And I would say it's almost as good as Rambo as well.
You know, I was telling you that the other movie that we didn't end up watching was sort of like a logical nightmare endpoint of like the counterculture. This movie is a different kind of nightmare endpoint. This is taking Walking Tall, the original, which is this authentically grassroots piece of right-wing kitsch. This thing that crawled out from under a rock somewhere in Tennessee in the early 1970s, and it's gentrified, and it has all of its edges sanded off, and it has a slick sheen, and it has a pro wrestler in it who's doing this as like part of his career pivot to movie stardom. And its politics are also ugly and noxious and right wing, but in a way that doesn't have any blood in its veins. It's just, oh, these are the boxes that you tick when you make a movie like this.
Yeah, man, they paved paradise and they put up a parking lot because the movie is exactly the same in many ways. Like it is, you know, its politics, such as they are just the same like Nixonism, silent majority bullshit, but updated to 2004. But all of the edges are just shaved off. The plot is almost identical, but they actually cut out the whole election sequence where Buford Pusser runs in, you know, the corrupt sheriff's election. And then, you know, there's that great scene. I don't know why I'm saying it's a great scene. I don't want to make it sound like I enjoyed Walking Tall. but I did enjoy it.
I kind of liked it, but whatever.
Yeah, Will actually likes Walking Tall. But like, I'm not being facetious when I agree with you here. I did enjoy it in a way that I did not enjoy this. This felt very much like, yeah, straight to TV, early 2000s thing, inspired by a true story indeed. Like that whole election plot is gone.
He's not married in this one. In the original, much of the drama came from the fact that, you know, he was a family man who brought his family into this squalor and degradation in this town and ultimately ended up sacrificing them for the cause of justice. This doesn't have any of that. In fact, in this one, it's all about him like saving a young exotic dancer.
Well, that plot is in the original Walking Tall or something like it.
That's true. Although in this one, it becomes the A story.
Now, Will, perhaps you can remind me, because I think there is one critical difference between The Rock Walking Tall and the OG Walking Tall. What was the source of social decay in the first Walking Tall. The Buford Pusser character moves back home after his career as a wrestler. Fun little Easter egg there. You know, they cast a wrestler in Dwayne The Rock Johnson in the same role. But had something happened to the town, or did he just find that it was bad? Because in the one we watched today, in the remake, the town has had a mill that has been the source of the prosperity, and its closure 6 months before the movie begins is the cause of all the problems. So it's very much a post-industrial retelling of the original story.
Yeah, and I actually kind of like this. I think this is the one semi-creative thing this movie does with the Walking Tall lore. In the original film, the town was operating perfectly, basically. It was full of, you know, good, God-fearing Christian citizens, but it had this pustule in the middle of it, this zit, which was the lucky spot, I think it was, you know, that watering hole / gambling den / house of ill repute.
Right, the place where people occasionally gamble in the back, while in the front of house, they host shindigs that are basically just like the saddest office parties you've ever attended.
Yeah, and there was some tension in that original film about, well, if this town is so good, then how is this house of ill repute able to prosper? Like, there's a sort of suggestion that it's separate from this town. It's this like cancer that has developed in the town, but is not of the town per se. Like, in fact, in the original film, its tentacles went all the way up to the top, you know, like
it went up to the state house. Yeah. And the governor's yeah. mansion.
But this one, I think, creates a plausible explanation. Well, sorry, I don't want to give it that much praise. It's like, I think we could reclaim this movie for the left. It's like, yeah, the mill is gone out of town and people are desperate. People are hopeless. They have nowhere to work. And so what do? They go to the big mega casino. This is another thing that's different about this movie. In the original movie, it was like the shittiest casino ever. It was just like some chairs and some blackjack tables. But in this one, it's like Las Vegas has come to rural Washington.
People used to walk tall in this town. They wouldn't have traded the mill for a crooked casino.
Stefan, we're not here to listen to civic speech.
And they wouldn't have stood around while drugs were being sold to kids.
Objection.
Sustained. Mr. Vaughn, you're close to being held in contempt.
I was justified in what I did. And if you acquit me of these charges, then I'm going to run for sheriff.
Mr. Vaughn.
And if elected, I'm going to fix this town.
Order.
We will come properly to the plot in a moment, particularly for the benefit of listeners who may not have seen the original Walking Tall or listened to our recent episode on it. But just further to your point about the mill, I agree with you that this at least, you know, makes more sense than the original Walking Tall. There's something a little more coherent about it to me. It's certainly realistic and is in fact a pretty commonplace thing for a town, particularly one of this size, to lose a major industrial facility like a mill or a factory, an auto plant, something like that, and then for a casino to open. That's a process that many towns in North America, towns and cities, have undergone throughout the past 30 or 40 years. Nonetheless, the way the film executes it is so hilariously heavy-handed, and this is where I feel like the right-wing ideology of the movie really comes through the most strongly, because it's not just the casino, right? Chris Vaughn's dad, Chris Vaughn Sr., played by John Beasley, who I think the implication is that he used to work at the mill. There's a scene where they're driving through town and just over his shoulder, you know, one of them spots an adult video store. And the implication is like, ah, that's what you get with deindustrialization. You get adult film stores and you get a corrupt casino where they rig the dice games and they have strippers in the back. And I just love the implication that, yeah, this town that employed thousands of guys in a mill, like, yeah, there was no market for this stuff before. This decrepitude has only come with the mill closing down.
So yeah, Chris Vaughn comes to town. His father is there. His mother is there. The whole family's there.
He reconnects with a few old friends as well, one of whom may not be all he seems, or so it seems to me.
But there's also Johnny Knoxville, a kind of fallen friend. You know, he's the comedy relief of this story. He basically plays the function that Felton Perry played in the previous movie. You will remember that in that film, Buford had a best friend who was black, the purpose of whom was to show that the movie was not racist. Well, The Rock is, of course, American Samoan, so this movie doesn't have quite the same issue. So now he has a funny white sidekick.
Well, they do make his family mixed race. But yeah, in this one, his sidekick is the guy from Jackass, which I have to say, I kind of like Johnny Knoxville's performance. I like Johnny Knoxville. It's fun to see him in a movie like this.
Yeah, he's fine. He completes the assignment. I'd also say The Rock is, you know, perfectly fine too.
One thing I will say for The Rock is this is 2004, and Jesus Christ, this guy was yoked. I mean, what a physique. Unbelievable. This is a guy who takes his vitamins.
Again, another way that this movie has gentrified the original movie, which starred a real man, Jodan Baker, you know, 240 pounds of raw man, you know, just a big frickin' slab of meat. I mean, that's what a man is supposed to look like. I'm sure you'll agree with that, Luke. So the film parallels, as if you're speed reading the script of the first film, abbreviated run through of the story.
Yeah, it's very much a Walking Tall speed run. And, you know, like the original Walking Tall, there's absolutely no subtlety to be had. Do you remember in the first one, it opens with that credit sequence where it's like, ah, the nice white bread family is driving into the heartland. Gosh, it would be the worst thing in the world if something were to happen to these people. And in this one, you know, right away, you know, he rolls into town and he says to some guys who pull up, you know, I'm looking for work in the mill. And they're like, oh, it's closed. but you could go find work at the casino. And he says, you know, no thanks. Establishing, of course, that, you know, he's a man of virtue. He wants nothing to do with the casino that, you know, he then goes to a few minutes later. But it turns out these guys who pulled up, one of them is the sheriff, who immediately starts teasing him, starts jabbing him. And I don't know about you, Will, but I kind of had a hunch that this sheriff was going to rue having teased The Rock. Much as in the scene a few minutes later where he's reconnecting with his old friends and playing football, the guy who does him a dirty and tackles him, I feel like he's going to get his comeuppance a bit later.
It's all connected, folks. So Chris Vaughn goes to the new casino. He gets to see how cool it is. Neil McDonough, the sinister Neil McDonough, by the way, a real life Hollywood Republican. And I say this with affection, by the way, it's well known. Neil McDonough will not do kissing scenes in movies because that would be cheating on his wife.
Oh, bless him.
I find that kind of sweet. I'm not making fun of him. I just think that's interesting.
I did not know that Neil McDonough was a Republican. I only know him as Lieutenant Hawk from Star Trek First Contact, who is the guy, or I guess one of many, who gets absolutely owned by the Borg about halfway through. But anyway, that's cute that he's a Republican.
He's a good actor. I like him in movies. I think he's charismatic.
You know, he is well cast as a villain because he has what sort of appear to be gentle features, but there's something kind of diabolical about them as well.
He's a real slick operator, the owner of this casino, and much like Joe Don Baker, The Rock gets fucked up, beaten up, his chest cut open, and left for dead at the side of the road. And so, you know, I was going to say this next 10 or 15 minutes is really sped through, but goddamn, the whole movie is sped through. I felt like I was watching it at 1.5 speed.
The movie does indeed play out at a breakneck pace. And, you know, much of it is pretty forgettable. There were two details about the scene in the casino that I really liked. First off, another little Easter egg for fans of sci-fi. The croupier who's rigging the dice game is one Aaron Douglas, a Canadian actor who people will know as Chief Tyrol on Battlestar Galactica. Love that guy. I also like, and this was the only thing in the movie that made me laugh out loud, the bouncer that comes up and starts a fight with The Rock is like, I don't know, 2 or 3 inches shorter than him, if not more. And I don't know, I just love the idea. This scene is worth checking out because it's very funny if you look at the guy, the idea that this guy would ever start a fight with The Rock. Needless to say, you know, he, like everyone else in the film, soon learns that they've fucked with the wrong hombre.
And again, a speed run of events from the first film. Chris Vaughn gets his revenge. He drives his pickup truck up to the casino, picks up his gun, but decides he knows what brand he's in. He picks up a big 2x4, the iconic walking tall 2x4. All of us fans in the audience are cheering and clapping like seals.
There's a fun piece of trivia on this. I don't know why this is the case, but it really tickles me that the IMDb page has so many details like this included in the trivia section. Director Kevin Bray wanted to update the pusser stick by making it a baseball bat instead of a piece of wood, but there were objections, so the compromise was just to add a handle.
I mean, as a walking tall super fan, I would not have stood for that. Anyway, Chris Vaughn fucks things up. Once again, he gets arrested for the mere crime of doing crimes. He gets hooked up with a sinister lawyer from Corruption Bribery and Corruption LLC who urges him to do a plea deal. But no, he fires his lawyer, does a fiery speech in the courtroom, shows everybody his fucked up chest and says, if you acquit me, I will run for sheriff and I will clean up this town. Of course, he is acquitted. And I think any real courtroom would have a serious case of judicial misconduct on their hands for allowing this to go through.
This is where the film's politics, you know, whatever else you might say about how, you know, there's a mill that closed or whatever. Its politics are basically the exact same as the first. You know, The Rock gives like a pious sermon to the jury. And he says, you know, I grew up in this town. I know this town. They used to walk tall. They wouldn't have traded the mill for a crooked casino. And they wouldn't have stood around while people sold drugs to kids. Oh, yeah, that's another detail we forgot is that they're running a drug ring. You know, they're selling meth out of the casino. and The Rock's brother, his little brother or nephew, he ODs on it, which is the thing that actually triggers his rampage at the casino.
You know, one evolution between 1973 and 2004 is, like, when the first Walking Tall came out, the people who went to see it were, like, full of righteous anger. Like, that movie hit its audience, the people who it responded to, like a lightning bolt. They were like, yeah, our towns are getting fucked up by vice and degeneracy and all that. But by the time this one came out, all this stuff, like, they're selling drugs to our kids, oh, a casino has replaced the mill. Again, it's just kind of like a checklist. These were features of the genre at this point, whatever this was. You know, just as if you had a Dracula movie, you'd get a wooden stake and you'd get a cross and you'd get all those signifiers. You know, this has just become like a template at this point.
Yeah, and it's completely formulaic. The politics are the exact same. You know, The Rock gives his sermon about, like, you know, we used to walk tall. And the judge is like, you know, we aren't here for a civics lesson, sir. But, you know, he wins, as in the original, by going over the heads of the elites and going straight to the people who, you know, as we all know, juries, famously incorruptible body that has never presided over a miscarriage of justice or gotten a case wrong. They have a pure and incorruptible sense of right and wrong. And of course, they acquit him immediately. Total silent majority shit. Nixonism for 2004. Extremely stupid. The film, further to Will's point about what a breakneck pace it has, then just skips over the entire election plot. Now, Will, we may need to do another episode at some point, because somewhere out there, I think there is something resembling a director's cut that includes deleted scenes and an alternative ending, or so the IMDb trivia page tells me. But the film just skips ahead. There's no exciting chase scene where the sheriff tries to kill him. The sheriff, who is hassling him right at the start of the movie, is just like, ah, well, I guess the best man won. Sir, here are my deputies. I turn them over to you. And The Rock is like, okay, you're all fired. There's then a pretty funny scene where he pulls over his old friend, Jay Hamilton, the Neil McDonough character, who the film positions as, you know, a country club ass motherfucker. He's driving a Porsche, and The Rock has somehow, again, with no real explanation or certainly no evidence that I could see, The Rock has already exposed just effortlessly the fact that, you know, he's the center of the drug ring in town.
Only thing that's going on in my casino right now is construction. You took care of that.
Yeah, that's right. I plan on taking care of everything else too.
If you can, try to think this through. A casino is a license to print money. Why would I jeopardize that by selling drugs?
Because you own the town, Jay. That's changed now.
Really? See, the only thing that I think has changed around here is that you get to wake up every morning and put on that nifty little badge.
But Neil McDonough's not having any of it. He says, you know, you're nothing, man. Underneath that badge is the same guy who couldn't make it in college football. You know, never had the makings of a varsity athlete. And, you know, apparently couldn't make it in the army either. But The Rock, you know, stoic avatar of unbending masculinity, just says, license and registration, please. He then says, sir, get your taillights fixed. Jay Hamilton says, you know, what do you mean? What are you talking about? The Rock smashes them. And he says, look, they're broken. And apparently, this is how you know The Rock's legit. Apparently, he wasn't actually supposed to smash the lights on the Porsche, but The Rock is so method that he actually did. It was a rental, and he smashed the shit out of it.
Good for him. I like that. But this movie is all Act 2, no Act 3. And compared to the original film, where you'll recall, I mean, we definitely felt that the original was a little long, because the whole middle section of that movie was, you know, Buford being flummoxed by this vast web of corruption all through the Tennessee town. This movie has a single locus of corruption, which is the Neil McDonough character and his casino. That's all there is. There's no problem solving. There's no mystery. There's not even really, in the original, Buford was constantly, like, being stymied by bureaucracy and trying to find workarounds for, like, you know, the corrupt judge, the bad politicians, you know, people like that. In this one, none of that. It's just The Rock and Johnny Knoxville, and they've got it all figured out 20 minutes in.
Right, and we alluded to this before, but there's also the whole plot with Denny, played by Ashley Scott. She's The Rock's romantic interest, and there's no tension in their relationship either, apart from the scene where she he's introduced is the scene where, you know, having dismissed the idea of working at the casino because he's too virtuous and pure, The Rock promptly goes to the casino when Neil McDonough says that his visit will be comped. And, you know, this guy who has taken such issue with there being a single adult video store in this town of, I don't know, 150,000 people, immediately goes to the back room to watch a stripper do a private dance for him. And they have this awkward encounter because he realizes that it's this woman, Denny, who is somebody that, I don't know, he knew from high school or something. Denny really only appears in a handful of scenes. I'm pretty sure the next time we see her, he's at the sheriff's office and she just brings him food. And he says to her, you know, shouldn't you be at work? And she says, oh, I quit. You know, you're cleaning things up around here and I thought I could do my part and do the same. He's eating noodles. She says, how's the food around here? And he shows her like a cup of soup that he's eating. And she very sensuously tells him that she's brought him a Tupperware with some cold potato salad, which the film positions as like a step up from a hot cup of noodles. I thought that was kind of funny. And then the two of them feature in a sex scene that I thought was vaguely Wiseau-esque. It was pretty embarrassing.
Act three, such as it is basically one action scene. Shortly after they've consummated their relationship, Neil McDonough and his gang put out the hit on him. As they wake up in the morning, the home is showered with bullets, and there's a long final confrontation in the woods between Chris Vaughn and the Neil McDonough character. Mano a mano. And the movie ends, and this is one of those things where, you know, if you're walking down the stairs and you get distracted and you think there's one step more than there actually is, and you're like, oh shit, you're just off balance for a minute, you're worried you're gonna fall over. The movie ends. The movie fucking ends at 74 minutes with Johnny Knoxville and The Rock putting a closed sign over the casino and driving away.
Yeah, we thought this one was gonna be a tight 90 minutes, but it turns out it was a very tight 74. Walking tall, more like running very fast, if you ask me.
And then after that, there are 12 minutes of credits, and they don't even do the master of disguise thing of having bloopers and deleted scenes. The credits just go very slowly.
Yeah, can I just say they closed the casino, but there's nothing in the montage where like you see the mill reopening or something. Yeah. It seems to me they've just cost the town hundreds of good paying jobs. Couldn't they just keep the casino and get rid of the rigged dice and eliminate the drug operation?
I mean, doesn't it feel a bit like the pilot episode of a TV show to you? I mean, there's no sense of closure. It ends with, and the adventure begins. You know, there's no catharsis. Yeah.
The adventure being, if this film was realistic, all of the casino jobs being replaced by payday loan stores and liquidation worlds.
Yeah, I think after 2 years in office, as his approval numbers are plummeting because all the mill jobs that went to work at the casino are now unemployed, I think Sheriff Chris Vaughn will be courting all sorts of, you know, vice merchants to bring another establishment in town, this time with Chris Vaughn getting his cut. Because remember, that's the snub that launched all of this. That the fact they didn't give him his winnings at the table. If they'd just given him his $30, we wouldn't be here.
Yeah, if this was the first episode of a TV show and it was realistic, he would probably seek higher office and then, as like a Republican state senator, pass a bunch of legislation that eliminated the rest of the mills in the state and outsourced the rest of the jobs.
It's awesome that this says inspired by a true story, because the one thing this character has in common with Buford Pusser, the real one, it's what if a guy was conservative? That's the one link. But I am optimistic for this arm of the Walking Tall franchise, because this has a number of direct-to-video sequels starring Kevin Sorbo, and I'm hoping that's where we're going to get the real juice. You know, I'm hoping we're going to get a bit of that right-wing id that was so prevalent in the 1973 original. You know, I want to see it flowing again.
Yeah, give me some blood and fire. I will just say that this film ends with a dedication, which is as funny as the caveat at the beginning about how it's inspired by a true story. Unless I was misreading it, Will, when the title cards begin to play, the first words you see are dedicated to the true memory of Sheriff Buford Pusser.
He said he didn't want no extra pay. And Buford went on hunting for stills and crooked life. One day the blood jaw half off and shot and killed his wife. But he survived and arrived alive and just kept living on. He swore that he'd get him
after his wife was gone. He went back to the lucky spot to call and drove his car right through that barroom wall. And then the folks who lived in town all came out and burned it down, and Buford was a hero in disguise, a man whose heart is twice his body's size. In McNary County, Tennessee, so the people say, the tales of Buford Pusser still live on today. In McNary County, Tennessee, so the people say, the tales of Buford Pusser still live on today. They still live on today. They still live on today.